This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing, my chance to talk with artists, policymakers, and performers, to hear their stories, what inspires their creations, what decisions change their careers, what relationships influenced their work. Charles Munn's quest to save the Amazon rests on a simple premise. If people have a peak experience in nature, they'll be more invested in protecting it. Over the past four decades, the conservation biologist has helped to preserve over 12 million acres of rainforest in South America, home to what he describes as the most biologically diverse protected areas on Earth. An Oxford-educated zoologist, Munn now heads up a nonprofit called Tropical Nature, which helps plan adventure tours in South America. Visitors can watch rose-colored dolphins splash in the Amazon, or pumas silently hunt their prey. You can see the wild through the eyes of an expert. And I've been there. I went to Peru with Charles Munn in 2000 to shoot a documentary for TNT directed by the great Robert Drew. Munn's tours are memorable, but the byproducts are better. Local jobs, community engagement, and a surge in the value of the rainforest. Still, for the son of a legendary Palm Beach family, it's a delicate balance between access and exploitation, one he prepared for in a different type of jungle.
I was working for the Bronx Zoo, or the field division of the Bronx Zoo, which is the headquarters of really what calls itself the Wildlife Conservation Society.
Before the New York
Zoological Society originally,
right.
And it has several zoos in the aquarium, you know, the Central Park Zoo, the Bronx Zoo. The international division does conservation field work, research on rare species, wildlife species, and mostly the tropics and some also temperate latitudes, China, a lot of countries around the world. Usually 70 countries they work in doing field conservation. So they're one of the biggest conservation groups in the world.
But WCS.
Yeah, WCS.
And where are they headquartered, in the Bronx?
Well, their headquarters is the Bronx Zoo, yes. Mm-hmm. Indeed.
And how long had you been working with them at the point that I met you?
I've been working for them for 16 years at that point. I was working in the Amazon the whole time. My specialty was the Amazon and other parts of tropical South America.
And you grew up in suburban D.C.?
In the Baltimore area.
Mm-hmm. The Baltimore area. Mm-hmm. You lived on a piece of property that was adjacent to some reserve that you became?
Well, I have a small conservation easement that I protected 50 acres from development. It was going to be turned into 20 or 30 houses. And I was able to buy it when I was young and protect it. And it has oak trees and other large deciduous trees that are more than 3 feet thick. And so I think it's the tallest, biggest forest. It's not a big forest, but it's 50 acres. But I think it's the biggest trees within a half an hour of the Amtrak line between New York and Washington. I think they're bigger than in any of the protected areas of the Maryland state or Pennsylvania or New York.
What was it about you when you were that age that you decided you wanted to take money of yours and buy land and preserve? How old were you when you executed that deal?
Let's see. I think I must have been 16 or 17. I had to convince my trustee to dip into what was going to be
resources.
Yeah, which I wasn't supposed to be able to do. But since it was not a bad thing to do, he eventually agreed because I was already fanatical about protecting nature.
And what do you think it was? I mean, most 16-year-olds, I think, isn't saying, oh, let's go buy this 50 acres of land with these wonderful trees adjacent to the Amtrak line and preserve it. Why were you heading in that direction?
I just think I had been hypnotized by some very beautiful songbirds when I was a 9-year-old boy.
And, truly.
They just captivated me. And I always felt since then that if other people could see the birds and other beautiful animals as well as I did, they would also fall in love with them and want to protect the habitat. So it's as simple as that.
Tell us about Chandler Robbins.
Well, Chandler Robbins is appropriately named Robbins. He was a great ornithologist who were one of the best bird guides in the history of the world. And he worked for the U.S. government as a field biologist, as a bird scientist for them in Laurel, Maryland. When I was a young boy, he was our idol because he would come up to the Maryland Ornithological Society meetings every May in Ocean City, and he would be like the god when he would appear.
Right.
So I'd go out birding with him, you know, try to tag along with him and other serious older birders and see if I could learn something.
But where does this birding begin? Where does your passion for this begin?
Well, it's the white-throated sparrow and the myrtle warbler in breeding plumage, specifically. If you see either of those in breeding plumage up close, it will change your life forever.
And you were how old when they changed your life?
A 9.
And you're sitting in the backyard of your home, your family's home?
Actually, the white-throated sparrow was at the neighbor's bird feeder, because in the wintertime, they have a boring plumage. But then they switch to their breeding plumage, and that's pretty spectacular. And the myrtle warbler comes through in May every year. It flies up through New York and Central Park in probably May 10th or so. And that was just an amazing bird. And I had no idea that it was not just one kind of warbler. There were like 40 kinds of warblers you could see in one morning, all heading up to Canada to breed in the summer. So I was amazed. All these beautiful butterflies almost of the bird world were coming through Maryland and going through New York up to Canada. I didn't even know they were there until my stepbrother actually turned me on to this. He was a birder. He was in a circle of serious birders, one of whom was one of the biggest bird listers in the world, the Kaestner brothers, actually both of the Kaestner brothers. So
who were they?
The Kaestner's brothers were from Baltimore. And they were some
birders
of the most,
as well.
Yeah, I think they're maybe in the top 10 of the most bird species seen in their lives. In the world. One of them works for the State Department. The other one works, I think, for McCormick Spices, so they can travel the world. They each have their excuse to travel the world so they can bird more.
And your stepbrother was how much older than you?
He was 2 years older than me.
So he's 11.
Yeah.
Describe to me the Munn household that the 11-year-old boy and the 9-year-old boy are so passionate about birding.
Well, he was in this circle. Drum, my stepbrother, was in this circle with the Kaestner brothers, and they were so fanatical. So he was fanatical because he was in the same school with them. And then he started showing me these things. I said, wow, what? These things are around here? How come no one ever told me before?
Were you raised by people that were fond of this?
Not particularly. I mean, my mother liked nature. My father died when I was 3. So.
Right. Were you raised by a stepfather?
Yes, indeed, yeah.
And was he a naturalist?
Well, he liked nature also, but it was really a Drum and the Kaestner brothers, that whole circle that I sort of got involved with, and that they turned me on to birding. It wasn't either of my parents particularly.
No. When you finish school as a young man and you're about to go to college, what becomes the path to you then? What do you decide you want to do?
I only applied to 2 colleges, and I got into both, and I chose the one that had better bird watching. Which was Princeton.
Out there in Hopewell Junction in that area, there's better bird watching?
Well, yeah, there was the Institute for Advanced Study has a beautiful forest right next to the Princeton University, where Einstein used to walk and stuff to think about relativity and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah, other flying things.
Yeah.
And so you went there and got a degree in biology?
I did. Mm-hmm.
And then after that, what did you do?
I wanted to continue working on bird science, and I went to Oxford, got a master's there, came back to Princeton, did a PhD, always in the Amazon. I got stuck with the Amazon. I got the Amazon bug, you might say, although in the good way. I became obsessed with working in Amazon forests.
When did you first go there?
In 76.
You were how old?
21, I guess. I went with graduate students from Princeton. I was a senior undergraduate, and with John Terborg, who was the professor that we all idolized, who was working in the Peruvian Amazon. So I was able to tag along with him as a senior undergraduate.
You're 21, and you're with Terborg in the Amazon.
Exactly.
The Peruvian Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the place to go if you want to study birds? Is the as opposed to the Brazilian?
Well,
or the...
Let's see. The Amazon basin is the Amazon rainforest is the size of the 48 states.
Right.
22% of it has been cut, but 78% is still standing. That's a lot of forest. And so Brazil has the bulk of it, but after Brazil, it's Peru. Peru has 2 Californias worth of rainforest. That's right. A lot of rainforest. And so it is some of the highest quality rainforest in terms of species diversity and being pristine. A lot of the uncontacted Indian tribes left in the Amazon are in the Peruvian Amazon rather than Brazil.
Sure. Your work down there becomes what?
Well, it's if you give a mouse a cookie, I mean, it's one thing leads to another sort of inexorably. So if you're interested in birds and working in the Amazon is one of the most amazing things you can do if you're a bird scientist because the bird diversity there is much higher than anywhere else in the world. You'll have 500 species of birds in just a few square miles. There are only 10,000 in the whole planet. And the one park I worked in has 1,000 species of birds. The entire U.S. and Canada has about 850. So this one park about the size of Massachusetts has 10% of all the bird species in the world. So once you're working there, you become spoiled. You, if you're an ornithologist or a bird scientist, you really want to continue working in such
it's
a rich habitat.
The Grand Central Station of birds.
Pretty much. And I was lucky enough to work on mixed species flocks. What does that mean? Well, there of the 500 bird species, 330 live in the forest. Others live in lakes and riverbanks and things. But the 330 that live in the forest, a third of them, more than 100 species, live in mixed species flocks. So it's a very strange and amazing thing to see. You can have 70 species of birds in one flock at the same time. So and the best bird watching in those flocks is in the middle of the day. So it's like contrary. Oh, you have to get up early at dawn to see the birds. Well, in the case of the flocks, the best flocks to bird watch are in the middle of the day. In the Amazon, you should be bird watching in the middle of the day and have a late morning snack and a mid-afternoon snack. You should actually bird watch all through the middle of the day.
What's the area in the United States, and even just the 48, if you will, that has the most diversity of bird species?
The part of the U.S. that has the most diversity of bird species would be Texas and California. And they're amazing circles of crack birders in both states. And they always try to beat each other in annual counts, Christmas counts, to try to see who wins. I think usually some of the Texas birding groups tend to win, which is the most number of birds you can see in one day. So Texas is typically the winner.
When I met you in 2000, my then wife and I flew from New York to Miami, and then on to Peru and Puerto Maldonado, which I'm told has changed dramatically.
Well, it's gotten a lot bigger.
Yeah. And then we went a very long journey on the boat up the river. We get to this place. Had you ever been there before? Had you worked with those people before?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was
Campo Pato was a place you'd frequented.
That was a research site that I stumbled upon thanks to some tips from a local Bolivian Indian, actually, who was living in that part of the Amazon. Bolivia has a lot of Amazon forest, too. They have about 1.5 California's worth, whereas Peru only has 2 California's worth.
Right.
So he tipped me off about that clay lick where we watched macaws and parrots eating. And I thought he was kidding me. But when I started to ask him difficult questions, he could answer them really quickly. And so I said, well, he's on to something. So I went up and looked at that area. So I'd found that area a few years earlier thanks to local informants, which is the way we get everything done, is by relying on local people to give us great information that they don't even know is that interesting.
So when we went there, I mean, the film is what it is. Bob Drew, the famous documentarian, and his wife, Anne, we make a movie about the illegal market in exotic birds from that area. And how would you compare now what's going on in that department to what we experienced 17 years ago? Is it still a huge problem?
Actually, that part of the Peruvian Amazon, the problem was already declining when we visited. Because in part because of your visit brought attention to the area. And so there was more resources and more travelers visited the area. So the major concentrations of macaws and parrots at the clay licks were all protected at that point by new parks. And so really the black market bird trade out of southern Peru basically had stopped. It was more of a question of central and northern Amazon of Peru because the Peruvian Amazon is so enormous. So actually, things have gotten much, much better since you visited.
What was the smuggling like back then? They were bringing those birds into the country. How?
Well, in fact, the major smuggling of parrots would have been more out of Mexico and Central American countries up through the border into the U.S., sneaking them into the U.S. The smuggling of parrots wasn't so much from South America to the U.S. There was a legal export from some countries, not from Peru, but say Bolivia next door, until the 1980s. And in 1992, the U.S. passed a law outlawing the importation of wild-caught exotic birds. And the New York Zoological Society played a role in that, so did I, in helping pass the national law because there were already some state laws prohibiting exotic bird importation. So that put an end to a lot of the trapping because people couldn't sell it to the U.S. anymore. We actually were greener than the European Union. The European Union took many years before they finally shut down the sort of nasty, cruel bird trade.
When people would bring them in, how would they bring them in?
Well, they would typically sneak them in drugged so that they wouldn't be squawking and wiggling and drawing attention to themselves. So they would have them in suitcases or in little plastic PVC pipes that would be hidden maybe in parts of a car if you're driving across the border. One guy who was smuggling ridiculously rare, very valuable macaws out of Bolivia, he was, and Paraguay, in fact, he was sticking them in his hand luggage. He worked for Paraguayan National Airlines as a cabin steward. So he was sneaking them in his carry-on, drugged, and then selling them to
specific... Until one woke up one day
his buyer, as it were, the person that was hiring him to transport them as a mule to Europe, because he would fly them to Europe. He was caught. He was busted in the late 80s. And then so that made it difficult for that to continue. So actually the bird smuggling has declined a lot, really. It's good news.
You have kids?
I do.
And how old are your kids now?
33 and 29 and 20 and two 17-year-old twins.
No.
Indeed.
Five kids.
Indeed.
And are any of them in the family business, so to speak?
Well, I would say yes. Two or three of them are really serious about going into the family business. One of them is studying at Cornell Hotel School because we're involved in creating green jobs through ecotourism, which is a form of service industry.
Like the flotels.
Mm-hmm.
So when I leave, when we're done with the television show, what do you do after that? When do you start getting into the eco? You weren't in the ecotourism business then, were you?
We were using the argument of ecotourism development as the excuse for trying to convince politicians it was worth creating these parks. In the case of Tambopata, it's good that we talk about Tambopata specifically. That Connecticut-sized park now has about 500,000 bed nights of foreign visitors per year. And it's the best land use economically of that area, which is pretty remote and hard to get to, turns out to be ecotourism. And so we were right. And the wildlife was recovered, and there are thousands and thousands of jobs now related to this. And so that actually is a bulwark against the mining that's a little bit further west to keep the mining mess from flowing over into this area. So that's a big success. And you saw it when it was kind of in the early stages.
What do you think people in this country can do who want to have any kind of a participation in the solution here?
Well, I think there have been quite a bit of success in the last, say, 5 or 10 years in convincing large retailers. I'm not sure exactly if it's Home Depot and Lowe's or a number of them, I think, have taken a pledge to only sell wood from sustainable sources that actually can be traced to be sustainable as opposed to being laundered. And I think a lot of that initiative came from the World Wildlife Fund. They convinced industry to police itself to make it easier for—
And you believe they are?
I think they are. For you and I to do the right thing, to buy something that's sustainable. Now, producing trees and fiber is one thing that's very important in the Amazon. I'm a big believer in creating parks and Indian reserves and protecting
Let's
them with ecotourism. So that's also part of it. It's not the only thing, but I think a lot of people don't realize that there are 74 airports in the Amazon that have regular jet flights. A lot of people will guess they're 5 or 10. Even that, they'll think that's high. But in fact, it's 74. If 78% of the Amazon is still in forest, more than half of that is in protected areas. It's probably 30 times or 50 times more protected areas by percentage than the U.S. has. And that's extraordinary. And about half of that protected area is owned by Indians, or maybe 60%, 40% is in biological reserves. You can get to these protected areas within a half a day from one of these 74 airports. And so ecotourism has to be part of the mix, because you only need to have one lodge in partnership even with Indians, local Indians, at the mouth of a river of a million-acre rainforest park. And that one small lodge can have turnover of maybe $1 or $2 million a year, and it protects a million acres behind it because it keeps people from getting in behind it. So it's a very inexpensive way to protect enormous pieces of forest. And anything you can do that can slow down deforestation will help slow down climate change, because burning rainforest, especially in Brazil and some other countries, but Indonesia, it was about equivalent to the carbon release by the entire transport sector in the entire world. It's about 20% of all carbon releases from burning rainforest. Anything you can do to slow that is useful. So that's why I try to create parks and try to create green jobs related to protecting the parks.
And you, what would you say, from your experience, are the primary activities that are occurring that they're burning this rainforest? Logging, agriculture, beef cattle?
Yeah, I mean, a certain amount of logging, when done properly, is not very destructive.
Right.
If you're taking 5, 6, 7 species of trees, it doesn't tend to be too destructive, especially if you minimize the number of logging tracks or for the heavy equipment, and you fell the tree in exactly the right direction. You cut the vines attached to it so it doesn't bring down a bunch of other trees next to it. So things like that can reduce the impact of logging enormously. But as soon as you start to do 12, 15, 18 species of trees, you're destroying so much of the canopy that you're really opening up the forest to desiccation, and it becomes like a tinderbox. It can actually catch fire in the dry season.
What else are they doing there once it's cut down?
Well, when a lot of forest is cleared for cattle ranching initially, and also sometimes for soy farming.
And that's big down there?
It's quite big. And there has been an enormous – the good news has been an enormous drop in the deforestation rate in the Brazilian Amazon especially. The peak year was 2005, 2006, and it's gone down by more than half. The deforestation rate in Brazil has gone way, way down.
You attribute that to what?
It's been better policing by the Brazilian government, frankly. I mean, it's enormous areas to police. They have very few wardens or you know, agents who can check this. They actually collaborate with the U.S. Space Agency, and they get real-life images of new fires. And so they can send agents right there instead of trying to comb over an area the size of the U.S. You send an agent right to where you see the fire from the satellite, and you can find someone, some rancher who is cutting down much, much more forest than he's allowed. He's allowed to cut down a little bit, but he's not allowed to cut down anything like the amount that he tries to. So now they levy enormous fines on these ranchers, and they'll typically back off from doing that.
Coming up, Charles Munn on his unrivaled Jaguar guarantee. South America's ecotourism industry may help shield the region's wildlife from extinction, but on the continent where the safari originated, poachers still abound.
You know, I could describe it that if, God forbid, what was happening to elephants were happening to people, we would call it a massive genocide.
Right.
They're being exterminated for ivory.
On a mass level.
Correct. Right. Using the latest technology, and that's weapons, cell phones, sat phones, vehicles, aircraft, helicopters, and the ease by which massive amounts of ivory can be illegally shipped to markets has never been greater.
To hear more about Richard Ruggiero's story, go to heresthething.org. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. These days, Charles Munn is a legend, named one of the leading experts on wildlife tourism by Condé Nast Traveler, featured in National Geographic, Newsweek, and Time. But even before the world was watching, Munn was working on his mission to save the rainforest, which began, fittingly, by connecting with the people who live in it.
Well, I used to help Peruvians and Bolivians and Ecuadorians and Brazilians get involved in ecotourism to protect parks. So that's back since 1980. I mean, I've been using that as the argument. I only got more involved in actually trying to create sustainable systems with local partners in the 90s and in the last, say, 15 years. So I had to actually get more involved and try to actually organize trips to send people to see jaguars. For instance, we guarantee people will see jaguars. And they typically see them for hours a day, hunting right in front of you. It's amazing.
So tell me, who's the average client you have? Are they, what part of the world, if any, is it completely mixed, or are there parts of the world that more crave the jaguar,
the
Brentanol experience?
The British are absolutely nature-crazed.
Right.
There's no culture that loves their nature and their wildlife more than the Brits. And so they are an enormous segment, outsized segment compared to their population. What, there are 60 million people in UK, and they must represent, 30% or 40% of all guests coming to see jaguars and giant otters, and also the large birds. They love their birds like no other culture in the world, really.
Did you have to customize your flotels?
Well, we had to design the first ever flotel that had rooms as big as a hotel room. So I think our flotel rooms, our Jaguar suites, and I think they're the largest standard rooms on any ship in fresh water, maybe even in salt water in the world.
It's like an ocean liner.
Except it sits in one place right in the middle of the Jaguar. So the Jaguars walk by. In fact, you have a Jaguar window on one side and a much bigger picture window on the other side. But we have a Jaguar window on the side closer to the forest because there's a Jaguar alarm. If a Jaguar walks by, you look through the window and see it walk right by your cabin.
Any danger?
They don't seem to find anything interesting on the floating hotel, no.
Not a problem, ever.
Well, there are no snacks there. They're busy trying to hunt alligators.
That's their primary source of food?
Alligators and enormous guinea pigs. They're the 120-pound guinea pigs that are called capybaras. They love those.
Right, capybaras, I see.
They'll eat capybaras and they eat the caimans, actually. They're called caimans.
Now, when they eat the caimans, I mean, I've seen horrific videos of snakes devouring quilled animals and passing this through their system. Then eventually they die. They cut the steak open and see the quills sticking through their digestive tract. But when these animals, what do? They split them open, they cut them open somehow, and then eat the inside. They don't eat the skin of the caiman.
They eat almost everything.
They eat almost everything.
The jaguar has the most powerful bite of any cat in the world. So the tiger and the lion is bigger than a jaguar. But these big jaguars in this area, they grow much bigger than the ones in the Amazon because they eat so well their whole lives. The genes are the same, but they grow to enormous. They grow to their maximum size because they eat perfectly their whole lives. The males are 350 pounds. That's a pretty big cat. That's bigger than that's the size of a female lion, more or less. So they have a much harder bite. They have bigger jaw muscles than either lions or tigers, and they can crush the back of the skull of a full-grown cow or of a alligator or caiman like this. So once they've crushed the back of the skull, they've basically killed the caiman. They've paralyzed it, but then it's going to die immediately at me by cutting the spinal cord.
Sure.
It's basically paralyzed. It hasn't died in the first 2 seconds. It's still alive, but it's paralyzed. And they'll eat the thing for several days in a row. They'll eat for 3, 4, 5 days in a row and just sit there with their distended belly because they've eaten so much. They'll eat almost everything. They can chew up the bones. They can chew up the skin. Their jaw strength is incredible.
This is like a really good taffy to them. This is a really strong.
Pretty much. And the funny thing is, some jaguars that we were studying, tracking them, they would walk next to a field with young calves, you know, baby cows. And the other side of the fence, there was a little pigsty with some little piglets that were kind of seemed bite size. And these jaguars, day after day, night after night, would walk between the calves and the little piglets and ignore them, walk down to the river and jump on these things that are, these caimans that are basically like dinosaurs.
That's what they crave.
Yeah, they just had been taught by their mothers.
They didn't want pork or beef.
They had been taught by their mothers to eat caimans. And so they kind of ignored these things that would be much easier to eat and much easier to kill and easier to eat.
It was like a party. It was hors d'oeuvres everywhere.
And that's one of the reasons we're not too scared of them, because their mother didn't – you eat what your mother gave you as a kid. That's what you love to eat, and that's why the jaguars don't show interest in us, because their mothers didn't teach them to eat us, because they don't know if we taste good. They don't know if we're dangerous. If there are two of us, they don't know what the second human will do, you know. And so that jaguars are not crazy, crazy predators who just kill senselessly. If they make one wrong move, they can break their ankle, let's say, and then they'll die of starvation.
Right.
And that's what we see the jaguars do. They jump down 8 or 10 feet onto these big caimans that are like 9 feet long, that weigh more than the cat. And if they twist their ankle or break their ankle, their wrist, you'll see every year or two, you'll see one of the 50 jaguars that we know well that will let you watch them in real time all through the day. You'll see them with really, really bad limp. I mean, they can barely even walk. And in that situation, they often recover. It's amazing how tough they are. But that's one of the biggest dangers.
When the ones don't recover, what do they do?
I'm sure they starve. You know, they go into the bushes and probably
lay
hide
there
and starve.
You know? Yeah. Do you still have a home in the U.S. at all?
I do. I have a home in Baltimore.
You still do, in your native area there?
Next to that forest with the big trees.
You do. Yeah. You do. And how much time are you in the U.S. every year?
Every year it varies a little, several months. I try to catch the spring migration here in the eastern U.S. In April and May. But the big season for the jaguars is really June, July, August, September, October, November.
Sweltering hot, or it's a bit cooler there in the southern hemisphere?
June and July, it can be quite cool, quite nice that way. September, October, it gets quite hot.
Right.
October, a few rains start, a little bit more, just enough rain starts in early November that it cools off. So my favorite time of the year to do jaguar watching is actually early November. But because some guidebooks say November is the beginning of the rainy season in the Pantanal. People go, oh, the rainy season. Well, that's actually, the rainy season is a blessing because it's so hot sometimes in October. You're just praying for some rain.
Do you think that some of what you've learned and some of what you've created and supported down there, that could be applied to here at home as well?
Well, I'm interested in the cougars or mountain lions that exist in Florida. There are several hundred of them. They call them the Florida Panther. That's the local name for them. There are several hundred of them, and you don't see them. But I think with the right techniques, you could see them. And it's probably the most graceful of all. One of the most graceful cats is the puma or mountain lion when it's hunting.
So if you and I decide to open up the Flotel business, that's in the Everglades?
In the Everglades.
So what are they eating? What's their copy
bar? White-tailed deer. They're eating lots and lots of white-tailed deer. And of course, in the U.S.
So we're safe.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Well, I don't know. Once again, any large cat, as a human alone, don't trust any large cat. If you're alone, and don't turn your back on it.
Right.
Cats don't like to attack if there are several of you because they don't know what the second human's capable of.
Right.
They don't have direct experience with how dangerous we are or are not, because most of the time, unless we have a gun, we're not very dangerous for a large cat. I think the wolves in Yellowstone would be interesting because, the wolf tourism, I'm not quite sure how it works, but I understand there are a lot of people who love the wolf tourism. Travelers who want to see the wolves badly. I guess it's on the western edge of the national park, and then the ranchers near the park hate the wolves. And I think the wolf hunting has been reopened in that area. So that's an interesting situation where I'd like to know more about how the wolf conservation could create green jobs there and help protect wolves.
Right.
There was a New York Times story about how boring ecotourism is in the Amazon. That was a very unfortunate story.
But tell me about that.
The writer was a TV producer for one of the major networks who went to the Amazon and came back and said, I didn't see anything, basically. And that's because the Amazon's complicated. You have to know where the fruit tree is that has all the action. If you don't go to that fruit tree, you may not see a lot in the rest of the forest. But that fruit tree is stuffed full of monkeys and birds, and it's just amazing. There's no substitute for knowing exactly what's going on tree by tree in the forest. In a square mile of typical Amazon forest that's unhunted and has all the original animals, only two or three trees are stuffed full of animals that day. But you need to know which trees those are. And you have to be at those trees at the right time. Then you're going to have a great time. You'll get the impression that there are more animals in the forest than there actually are because they're all concentrated in one tree.
Right. Are there still any uncontacted Indians down there as far as
there
you know?
There are uncontacted Indians. And
more Brazil than Peru or both?
There are some pockets, especially in Peru and Brazil and Venezuela, where there are uncontacted tribes. That doesn't mean that they don't know that the outside world exists. That means that they're choosing to live out of contact. And they are out of contact, but it's not that they have no idea that there's something else. There's other stuff out there. But they choose to avoid it because they'll know from tradition that it's dangerous, because it typically is dangerous when they come in contact with Western civilization. We worked a lot with Indians who we helped title. While I was working for WCS, we raised $1 million for land titling of Indians to create a big buffer zones around the national parks. And that was quite effective, and many of the Indians that we worked with were some of our best executives and informants and gave us new ideas about how to make the rainforest more interesting. One of them, who had been working with me on macaws, said, you want to come to my house a couple hours away, and I've got a macaw there. And I said, oh, you mean you're working with macaws with me, and you cut a tree down and took the baby macaw as a pet? That's no good. He says, no, you don't quite understand. Come to my house and I'll show you. So we drove a couple hours by river to his house, and it was the end of the day. And he said, they'll probably show up any minute. I said, what do you mean they'll show up any minute? And suddenly these giant, these scarlet macaws flew out of the forest and landed right next to the house. I said, what's going on? And then they gave them snacks. They gave them some corn from their cornfield, and the macaws ate that, and then they flew away. I said, no, those were pet macaws. We never clip their wings, so they just come and go. They'll come and get snacks. They'll top off the tank a couple times a day. They're eating in the forest. They're wild macaws, but they come back to get snacks from us. I said, you're kidding. Really? You mean, because the second baby macaw, they have two babies. The second macaw starves to death normally. That's part of macaw biology. They want to raise one healthy one, and the second one's an insurance policy in case the first one's a dud.
Oh, wow.
So the second one almost always starves. I said, well, why don't we raise the second one in a field lab and release it? It'll come back to get snacks for the rest of its life. And, Alec and National Geographic photographers and guests will all get amazing photos of wild macaws that are like dual citizens. They'll come in and visit us and then leave again. You saw some of those birds. I think one of them was telling you you were a great actor, I think. Yeah. It was bobbing its head, and yes, indeed, you're a great actor.
It was doing lines from all my greatest films.
That's right.
Now, how much more do you see yourself doing this kind of thing? I mean, isn't there a part of you that wants to kick back and finish the whole thing or have a nice autumn of your years where it all started on your 5-acre ancestral home in Baltimore, bordering the 50 acres that you secured with your selling all your Halloween candy?
Well, I'd like to be a little bit less involved with worrying about whether we have enough ripe tomatoes in the kitchen. I'd like to be a little less involved in making sure that every single transfer from an airport to a hotel goes properly. I'd like to be less involved in the day-to-day operations and more involved with thinking about things like the Florida panther. We know now we have techniques that can be applied that have legs that can be used over and over again. There's no reason to have to rediscover the wheel. We know how to make macaws ridiculously fun and attractive, and it's easy. And yet, even when the country of Costa Rica, we propose that they have what I call assisted fledging. The second baby's going to starve anyway. Take it from the nest, feed it in a field lab, and release it. And it'll come back, and guests will get pictures of scarlet macaws next to national parks in Costa Rica. And they have 1 million tourists, and fewer than 1% get a good photo of a scarlet macaw at the moment. But if they did what I said, they'd have 99% of the people would be getting good photos of scarlet macaws. And that would mean people might spend an extra night in the country, and 1 million people spending an extra night, you can do the math. So, and yet Costa Rica doesn't take that suggestion seriously. I suggested that to them 20 years ago.
Why do you think that is? Because Costa Rica is renowned now as an ecotourism spot.
Well, they just outlawed all feeding of wild animals. You can't even feed a bird in your backyard in Costa Rica legally.
What is their thinking? What do they think is
happening? I don't know. I think it's purist biologists who have the training that I have, but who don't understand that if we don't, there's a continuum of, putting an animal in a cage and making it suffer and having a wild animal that you give a snack. And there's everything in between. You can have wild animals you don't touch at all. Wild animals, you give them a little snack to make them easier to see. If you can protect a forest by giving a few wild animals a little bit of a snack that doesn't hurt them And you can protect a million acres of forest by doing that. I'd much prefer that than torching the place to carbon, which is what happens literally. I think biologists have to be more dynamic about using their knowledge of animal biology and animal behavior to make animals more accessible and more visible. I challenge my friends, people are going to be mad at me for saying this, but I challenge my friends who go to Costa Rica, literally, to come back with trophy photos of wildlife. And they come back with precious little in the way of trophy photos of wildlife that could compete with what they saw in Kenya or in South Africa. And that's because the animals are there, but you have to be able to get close enough to them because the animals are smaller and they're not dangerous, but they're more colorful, but you need to be able to get close to them. And one of the ways you do that is by giving them a structured snack that is harmless.
Approved, yeah.
Yeah, and so, I mean, you can feed animals the wrong way, and I'm opposed to that, but you can also do something intelligent and make some animals more visible than they would be otherwise. You can see amazing birds. I actually asked the Costa Ricans, is anyone in the room? There were a lot of scientists in the room at the last meeting where they said, no, they're not going to allow assisted fledging of macaws. Has anyone been to Sydney or Melbourne where cockatoos are backyard feeder birds? I said, you should have 100,000 scarlet macaws in Costa Rica, not 1,600 like they have now. Every home in the lowlands in Costa Rica should have scarlet macaws as backyard feeder birds. What's wrong with that model? And there is nothing wrong with that model. But they actually, instead of heading in that direction doing tests, they've actually gone in the opposite direction.
What part beyond the South American rainforest? What are other places you crave?
I want to go to Antarctica.
You do?
Yeah.
Why?
And I haven't been to the Galapagos yet, which is embarrassing.
You haven't?
No.
Right. I would expect you would have spent many summers there.
Well, they already know what they're doing with ecotourism and conservation. They don't need any tips from me.
They don't need any consulting.
No. They don't need any tips from me. But I maintain that we have better wildlife viewing in the Pantanal in Brazil than even than they have. We have a lot of large mammals, giant otters, jaguars, a lot of large birds, capybaras, the world's largest rodent, as I said, the giant guinea pig, these big alligators and the caimans. And so we have four species of monkeys, see them ridiculously well. We have the largest parrot in the world, the highest of macaw there. So I maintain that we have something similar to or even in some ways better than the Galapagos. The Galapagos has no large predators.
There's no hunting. The animals just aren't there in the Galapagos.
Well, they have other very interesting animals, no question about it.
But the ones you're talking about.
They don't have colorful, big mammalian predators like that I'm talking about.
So the reason as you said before, the reason that your situation there is as vivid as it is and is as conducive to this ecotourism thing is the lack of hunting, correct? These animals feel safe.
The country of Brazil outlawed sport hunting in 1967, and that's amazing. I'm not even sure what they were thinking, but in fact, it's been amazing for my work because I've seen the quality of wildlife viewing in Brazil increase so much in the last 30 years. I just can't believe it. So a lot of places in the world are declining. The wildlife is declining, but in Brazil, it's a wildlife bonanza now. You can see pink dolphins ridiculously tame right outside of the city of Manaus. You can fly to Manaus, you know, American Airlines in 5 hours from Miami and have pink dolphins right around your legs. They don't care. And so Brazil has amazing stuff that I would never have predicted. For instance, that I could see jaguars on demand. I would never have guessed that was possible. And I spent years in the rainforest. I saw 25, 30 jaguars in the Amazon rainforest. In the Amazon, they're in the forest hunting wild pigs. And so you don't see them on the riverbank. But in the Pantanal, they're hunting the capybaras and the caimans on the riverbank, which is where those things live. And that's why you see them. You know, I have a story that I don't think I told you. Did I tell you what was happening in that blind while we were waiting for the macaws to come down?
Please, I'm on tenterhooks.
So it was there was a cameraman. One end of the blind was only, big enough for four or five people.
Yes, it was small.
And so I had my colleague, Peruvian colleague Eduardo Nicander was in the blind with me. He was sitting next to me, and you were just beyond him, and then I think Kim was just beyond him, and then the cameraman was sitting somewhere in there. And we were waiting for the macaws to come down and eat clay. And there was a raging flood next to us. It was January. That was a crazy time to go. It was a difficult time for this to work.
Right.
So the rain let up, and the flood was coming up, and it was starting to come into the blind. It was actually threatening to wash away the blind while we were sitting there. Did you notice that?
I was so engrossed
by that. Well, there were large tree trunks going by us at about 10 miles an hour.
Right.
And if one of them had hit the edge of the blind, that would have been the end. And there were rocks coming down this 100-foot-high clay wall not far from you and Kim, you know, these rocks coming down the size of your head, coming down 100, and they were smashing into the water. Did you notice that?
That I heard. I heard like a little plunk. I heard one. Remember, I heard a sound that I thought it was something had fallen down in the rain into the river.
Because I know what happens to those banks. Sometimes the whole bank collapses. Uh-huh. But there's a third thing that was happening all at the same time where we're all waiting for the macaws. Are they going to come down or not? And that is Eduardo Nicander sort of lifted his eyebrows and looked over in the corner and sort of indicated I should look down there. And I looked down there and there was a venomous snake had come into the blind, something that people are terrified of, snakes in the rainforest. But there was a venomous snake, a small one, but it was always about 6-7 inches, maybe a foot long. It had crawled because the flood was coming up, and it had scared this fer de lance snake into the blind. And so this fer de lance snake was sort of making its way over towards the two of you, you and Kim.
Right.
And I said to Eduardo in Spanish, I whispered to him, I said, keep them busy by whispering to them and tell them a few stories. And so he was telling you all a couple of stories, and you were listening to his little stories and as he was talking quietly. And I had a little stick in my hand, and I put the stick on the head of the snake, and I kept watching you all.
My God.
Hang on a second. And so I'm sort of smiling, listening to the story. But meanwhile, the snake's wriggling while I had it pinned down near its head. And then I had a Swiss Army knife, and I cut the snake's head off. So I'm sorry to say. I mean, I'm afraid I couldn't deal with that snake in any other way at that moment.
I'm grateful.
It was a small snake, but maybe I'm going to get in trouble now. But so I didn't tell you that, and this is the first time you heard that.
Oh, my God.
Because everyone's terrified they're going to see a snake when they go to the rainforest. And, you know, actually—
I was afraid they were going to come in my bedroom when I was in the little lean-to.
Well, exactly. You know, yeah. But I mean, so here we had the raging flood with the huge logs going by, a venomous snake, and these big boulders coming down the hillside, and you guys were— I think somewhat oblivious. And then the macaws came down and we filmed it and it all worked well.
You know what's great about going on these trips with a guy like you, a naturalist who's got a PhD from Princeton and all these kind of fancy...
That's piled higher and deeper, PhD.
Piled higher and deeper.
It's BS. MS is more of the same. PhD, piled higher and deeper.
Well, being with someone where it's piled higher and deeper, the great thing is, as I may die in the rainforest there in the blind, but at least I'll know how I die. You'll explain to me. It's the logs,
the genus and the species.
This snake that just bit you was a, what's it called?
A fer de lance. It's a French name for a South American and Central American pit viper related to the rattlesnake and the copperhead. But I don't want to like terrify people because, I mean, that's one of the few fer de lance I've ever seen. It just happened to be in the blind with
the
you and Kim.
In a recent interview with The Telegraph, Charles Munn captured why, as a zoologist, he promotes encounters with animals. Quote, there's a continuum from pets and animals in zoos to a wild animal in nature approaching you to really wild species that are terrified of you. I'm willing to use any point on that continuum, except captivity, to promote forest conservation. I'd rather have the monkeys running wild, but realistically, it's no longer an option, unquote. I'm Alec Baldwin. Here's The Thing Comes from WNYC Studios.